Review of gravitational physics course. So over the next 5 weeks, what we're going to do is we're going to take a somewhat deeper dive into general relativity and gravity, because you've already had a sort of introductory course. So there's roughly sort of the course is sort of comes in roughly three chunks. And if I just give you a bit of a roadmap, that's what we old people used to use to get around. So maybe you remember, you know what one of these things is. So today I'm going to review manifold basics. And the first sort of chunk of what we're going to be doing is going to be quite mathematical. We're going to go back to differential geometry, and we're going to really focus on the geometry part of it. So on Friday, I'm going to be doing more on manifolds, and a lot of this ought to be familiar, but I think it's sometimes quite good to see things for a second time. And I think I'll also be maybe doing a little bit more than Luke did. So we'll talk about forms, we'll go back to the Lie derivative, the covariant derivative I'm expecting you're going to be relatively comfortable with, but then I'll talk about Cartan formalism when we get to curvature, because some of the language and the formalism that you use, is sort of gets carried out into supergravity or quantum gravity. Then in the middle bit, I'll be sort of mixing and matching. I'll be doing some development of sort of ideas or formal theory, but I'll also be beginning to talk about some of the applications in gravity. And I think that you're going to find that black holes or black brains are going to feature quite strongly in the course, because, well, I just think black holes are great. So there's lots of good stuff to talk about with them. And I'll also, as I say, be flipping a little bit back and forth between formalism, actions, thermodynamics. And then towards the end, we'll talk with slightly more advanced topics, which my aim is really to try to give you the basics for working knowledge of working in gravity. So, a lot of the time you kind of, to be a real practitioner, you have to do a lot of examples, and that maybe that's not your thing. You're not going to have a lot of time to do examples. But if I give you the foundations, then if in future you need to do something, you can kind of come back to those foundations and then build on them. So it's basically about developing this toolbox. And so I'll talk about submanifolds, which kind of leads you to walls and brains. I want to talk a little bit about perturbation theory, because of course that really underlies a lot of the with the research going on in gravitational wave physics. And then my postdoc was super keen, begged me to give a lecture. So I'm going to give him one of my slots to tell you about analog gravity, which actually is part of an experimental consortium that I'm involved in, where we're sort of testing some ideas in gravity. I've just noted at the top there that I'm a bit worried I might go faster with slides. So I may even exceed the speed of light. So I apologize in advance if I do. If so, please go to previous year's PSI lectures if you want to just sort of, revisit again. But I'm hoping, because you've already done this material, that it won't be critical if I do speed a little bit. So, but if I do apologize in advance, if I do. Okay, and just another introductory slide to just be clear about my conventions, because conventions are basically a trap. that is that I take the plus, minus, minus, minus signature. I'm told that's what phenomenologists do. And I'm going to keep h bar and c equal to one. That's classic relativist. But I tend to keep g in by and large. And that's because when you dimension hop, the gravitational constant changes. It's, you know, the dimensions of the gravitational constant change. And I think that in the literature, sometimes that's not always made clear. And sometimes I think that it obscures certain things. So if you're focusing on gravitational effects, I think you should keep G in there. I'm going to use A and B for space-time indices, but they may not be coordinate indices. It's a generic index. Mu and nu will typically, though, be coordinate basis, and I'm going to be talking about that in a bit. I and J will be space-like indices, and capitals will be submanifold indices. So it'll all sort of fit together. But I may sort of flip between the Roman and the Greek, but in both cases, they're space-time indices. But one is very specifically a coordinate basis. The other may or may not be. Okay. I may just pause every so often to just ask a question or hear for some response, because with Zoom you're never quite sure if you're sort of talking to yourself, and I want to make sure the connection hasn't dropped. So I'm not trying to check that you haven't fallen asleep necessarily. I just want to make sure that you can still hear me. So I can hear somebody. I don't know whether it's someone having a quick coffee, but I can certainly just hear a small amount in the background, so that's fine. Okay, so gravity is it's a metric theory. When we think about GR, we think about what are our observables. Well, the observables, as Einstein always used to be quite clear, I think, in his thinking, were distance, or really actually light rays and clocks. And via a light ray with a clock, you could deduce space-like distance. So it's our observable is the metric, although that's not an absolute observable, it's all relative. And so in terms of trying to describe gravity or what's going on around us, we sort of have to ask, well, how do we sort of think about what we see? And of course, the main sort of conceptual breakthrough of general relativity was that Einstein realized that our space-time around us was not, in a sense, absolute. And also it wasn't rigid, so that, you know, things, distances were tended to change, so space warped. So what we find we need is differential geometry to describe that structure. So what we'll be talking about today and a little bit on Friday is the theory behind that and some of the mathematics. We're not going to be approaching this as mathematicians, because we're not really interested in why things are true. We're more interested in what they say about what is around us and how we can use them. So some of it will be more formal, because we need to know how to define things if we're going to use them, but it doesn't necessarily, you know, we don't have to be totally precise from a mathematician's perspective. So what is the essence of space-time? Well, it's a set of events. It's a set of things that happen in particular places. And we can think about the particular places in a very algebraic or combinatorial way, as having, as in what the label is, such as I look at my watch and I say at 4:41, I'm giving a lecture to the students over at the Perimeter Institute, where it is 11:41. But as well, we could just sort of think of the events just as literally just being, you know, the existence in and of them themselves, and then we can think about the relations between them. So the sketch there on the left, we have our manifold. So that's just some sort of generic blob there, and our events are just the little points on the manifold. So how do we sort of give that some more meaning? Well, a manifold in general is going to be sort of all curved and squishy. But in order to make sense of it, what we tend to do is we take the manifold and we kind of say, well, locally, it always looks like R to the N. So in our case, it looks like Minkowski spacetime locally, X, Y, Z, and T coordinates. And those sort of, we can take little flat patches and just sort of pop them down so that they cover the whole of our manifold. And that's our sort of atlas. So each of these little patches is called a chart, and I've sort of illustrated those with little circles on the diagram. And we have a map. The chart consists of the open set together with a map from that open set down to this flat space-time, Minkowski space-time, or in general R to the N. So our chart is the little patch together with a mapping into this underlying flat space. So this visually, I always think of this as the surface of the Earth and the atlas of the world. And the atlas is just a set of pages that you're always turning over. So each individual page is flat, it's R squared, it's a plane or a segment of one. And that page corresponds to some patch on the Earth. So that's, you know, the chart. Well, the chart is a word that goes back even further than an atlas. It literally is what people would use, just a you know, single sheet representing a map. So that is the basic of what a manifold is. And we say that, you know, this local labeling of these points is what we would call our coordinates. And then when two patches overlap, what we ask, and I know we don't, it's possible in mathematics to have less differentiability, but I'm just going to assume that everything is smooth, it's infinitely differentiable. So that, you know, all these transformations are wonderfully smooth. So if we have an overlap, the transformation of between the two different ways of labeling these points is infinitely differentiable. So we call this a C infinity manifold, and the set of charts was the atlas, as I've already said. And so our manifold really is just something that's locally flat, or another way of putting at it from relativity would be saying that we're in a local inertial frame, and that, but you build it up from patching together lots of these little flat pieces. And so once, since we know how to do geometry and calculus on our underlying flat space, we kind of use that knowledge and transport it over to the manifold. So we sit in the manifold, and what you'll be seeing a lot of is we have a neighborhood in the manifold. We look at where it goes in R to the N, and we use things that we know already in R to the N. And so that builds up our understanding of the general geometry of the manifold. So functions. So what I'm going to do now, having just sort of set up what the definition of a manifold is, I'm going to now start gradually layering some additional structure or additional, you know, pieces of information about the manifold. So the first of these to get started is function. So a function is just a map from the manifold down to the reals. And it's a C infinity function if it's C infinity in all of the charts. So here we have this picture of the manifold on the left. Our function goes down to the real line running along the bottom. So that's the map, the original map of that point plus some neighborhood. It just takes the manifold and gives you a number at each point in the manifold. To say it's C infinity, we then take a local chart, so these are these coordinates x mu, we go over to our underlying Rn, and then that sort of gives us, if you like, an induced map from R to the N down to the reals, And that we know how to differentiate. So as long as our function is infinitely differentiable in this local chart, then we say that is what it means to be infinitely differentiable on the manifold. And so we call this set of functions C infinity of M. So that's our function space. So I'll just pause and see if there are any questions, because it's not easy to, I can't really see your faces.
Sorry, what's written? It looks like you have X, maybe you said it already, but X to the M, what's that? Index up there? Or the
yeah, it looks like it looks like there's either been some, either I've my writing has gone bad, or there may have been something on the scanner. So that really should just be X mu, where the mu is this superscript. I don't know what the other bit of this bit next to the mu, that probably, I'm not sure if it is my pen dragging across the paper, or whether there was something on the scanner, because it does look a little bit dusty, doesn't it? So all this is meant to be sort of saying is you go from your local neighborhood in the manifold, you go over to R to the N, and then you ask that when you differentiate that function, it's infinitely differentiable. So okay. So that's one example of structure on the manifold. Another one is a curve. So a curve kind of goes in the other direction. So a curve is a map from the reals into the manifold, or some segment of the reals into the manifold. And again, if we want it to be a C infinity curve, is one such that the image in a local chart is infinitely differentiable. So here we've got the reals on the bottom. I've got an interval AB that maps to this line up in the manifold. So we have gamma of A being the starting point and gamma of B the ending point. And I can take a little patch of this curve and map it using, again, a local chart. And sorry, the writing's very sort of scrappy here. And I can take that down into R to the N. This gives me some set of coordinates, an X mu of T. And then I ask that is an infinitely differentiable, that image. So that's my curve. And the obvious examples are a world line of an observer, where we say X mu of T. So that's this, again, on the right, you see the real line. And we're mapping that into the manifold, which gives us some world line of some observer. Another example would be the circle. So that's a map from the interval 0 to pi onto the plane, such that t goes to cos t and sine t. So that's an example. That curve is the circle being traversed once. And I just want to emphasize that a curve is a path plus parameterization. So the same path traversed at a different rate is a different curve. So this line here is a path that the observer takes, but the world line, X of T, is the curve. And again, you'd get the same image if you had cos 2t sine 2t, but it would be a different curve. So the curve is very much path plus parameterization. And that's important when we do vectors. So are we cool with that?
Yeah.
Okay, so vectors. I think what's nice, or what I liked about differential geometry, is that it takes everything that you think is intuitive about vectors, and that is what they are. So a vector, I know that sometimes, you know, you meet it in the context of a vector space as some ordered triplet or n-tuplet of numbers. But actually, really, a vector is something with a magnitude and direction. It's something really very intuitive and very physical. And that's how a vector is defined in differential geometry. So, well, almost. It's interpreted as a tangent to a curve at a point P, but it's defined as a linear operator, which takes a function and gives its derivative. So the operator, the tangent vector T, is defined as a map from C infinity of M to C infinity of M, such that the function goes to df by dt. So what does that mean? Well, you have your curve gamma going through the manifold and going through the point P. And if you think about what is the value of f along that curve, you then get a function, or just a real function, because we have the map from the reals into the manifold, giving you the curve, and then the function takes you from the manifold back to the reals. So restricting f to the curve gives you an f of t. So that's this here, this f of t, f composed with gamma of t. That's a real function, and therefore we can differentiate it. And that's what that df dt is. Now that's for an individual f, but the point is that this operator has to do that for every single function in C infinity of m. So that means that it's not just a df dt for some specific f. That means that you can, notionally at least, remove the f from that expression df dt. And so in a sense, the tangent vector is sort of a d by dt at the point P. So that gives it a sense of direction, which is the direction the curve is going in at that point. It also gives it a magnitude, because I made the point about a curve being a path plus parameterization. If I try going faster along the curve, my t will increase in length, because the way in which I've parameterized my curve changes. So that leads us to the fact that this forms a vector space. So this is what I was just saying. If I have a gamma of t and I change the rate at which I'm moving along the curve, so I make gamma of t on lambda, that takes t, but my operator goes to lambda times the operator. So rescaling the parameterization by a number rescales the vector. So that's how that sort of tells us about multiplying vectors by a scalar. But a vector space, of course, there's various axioms forming a vector space. You've got to have it as an abelian group under addition. And that's what the second part of this is. If we can sort of construct a composite curve, if we have two curves going through a point, if we go down to a local chart, we can make our origin, if you like, at P, and we can construct a third curve, gamma 3, by adding together gamma 1 and gamma 2, literally directly. X3 is x1 plus x2, and then the two tangents vectors, s and t, if I add those together, I'm getting a t plus s operator, where I simply take df by dt and I add df by ds. So that's essentially that will give me the same tangent vector as going along the curve, gamma 1 plus gamma 2. So having demonstrated that we can add these operators together, we can rescale them, that's really what we need for having a vector space. And that's called the tangent space at P, TP of M. So that's, of course, a distinct space from the manifold, and it really is only defined at P. We can collect together all of the tangent spaces at all of the points of M, and that's called the tangent bundle, which is just all of the tangent spaces. So I think quite often thinking of the sphere is very useful when you're doing differential geometry, because it's a nice manifold. It's two dimensional, so you can easily visualize it. It's not flat, so it gives you some notion of the effects of curvature. And it's very good for thinking about these tangent planes. So here I've drawn or sketched a tangent plane to the North Pole. And notice how the sphere is a compact manifold, but the tangent plane is flat. It's the plane literally touching the sphere at the North Pole. And so we directly visualize it as that plane sitting on top of the sphere. And so it really is a very different space. And then all of the tangent planes would just be all the planes all the way around the sphere. And then the other important object, having defined a vector, is a covector. And these are defined, again, mathematically, via maps from the tangent space down to the reals. So I think one of the things that is conceptually takes some getting used to is that we don't often have this distinction between vectors and covectors when we do normal three-dimensional vector calculus or vector analysis, because the vector space and the covector space are actually pretty much the same thing, because there our metric is just the delta, you know, the delta AB, it's just the identity. And so in essence, we often think of our vectors with an index up, but the covectors with an index down, but there's often not, you know, we're not used to being disciplined about which is which. So here, because we're not doing things in that rather 19th century way, thinking about indices, we're thinking about geometry. If we want to define our covector, we have to think about what it does. And what it does is it takes a vector and gives us a number. And notationally, the mathematicians will usually put the first of these things, omega of v. But you will also sometimes see the Brahe and Ket notation, where the covector goes on the left and the vector goes on the right. And indeed, actually, that notation, which sort of comes, I guess, from partly Hilbert spaces, is also correct notation for what is a vector or a covector. So I guess here it might help to think of the dot product, because the dot product is if you sort of imagined just taking a vector and sort of thinking of V dot something, that V dot operator would be this this covector. So I'm calling it omega just to try and emphasize, if I denote Greek objects as covectors, it helps you sort of distinguish them from the vectors, which will be the Latin ones. This is also a vector space at P, and it's called the cotangent or dual vector space. So that's now denoted by TP star of M. So those are, notice that I'm in this slide, I'm bold facing vectors and covectors. When I write it on the board, I'll underline them to draw the attention to the fact that it's a geometric object. So I'll just pause again to see if there are any questions. I'm guessing you've largely met this.
I've got a question. Mm-hmm. So I've heard there are some interesting ways to visualize cotangent spaces. Do you have any ways? I mean, I know, so from the definition, it's clear what it is, but do you have any methods of visualizing it?
So I guess when we talk a little bit about forms, I mean, the single, just a co-vector, literally, it can sometimes be, you can sometimes sort of think of it as a sort of a normal to a sort of set of surfaces. And this kind of comes via a sort of, I guess, a sort of notion of duality, because the sort of simplest covector that you can think of is like a gradient of a function. So if you think about some function on a manifold and then think about constant F surfaces, these, you know, I guess you just sort of visualize these, you know, crossing the manifold. And then you ask, what is the gradient of F? Well, the gradient of F is kind of normal to those surfaces, but in fact, the gradient of F is one of these covectors. So I guess I partly think about it in terms of that kind of dual picture. I guess that's not super helpful. But I suppose because most of the time I work with covectors, I'm in a metric space. I'll have to have a conversation when I actually get there in person so you can sketch things on the board. So what had you read? What were you thinking of?
Well, I only heard one thing from Vincent over here, that it's something like level sets, but I don't know.
Okay, that sounds more like an algebraic definition. So... yeah, no, I think that, you know, if you think of the gradient of a function, that is like the prototypical covector. And that in itself, it, whilst obviously it's just a single object, it has this interpretation as being normal to surfaces. And so that's, yeah, I guess I think of it as being that gradient. I'm sure Ms. Nathorn and Wheeler have some snazzy pictures about it.
It almost seems like then there would be fewer covectors than vectors, though, because if you have like a tangent plane, right, you can have infinitely many vectors in that tangent plane, but then there would only be like one normal vector to that plane coming from the point.
To that plane, but there are infinitely many planes that you can put through a point.
Yeah. Oh, that's
so, yeah, I mean, you can, so, yeah. I mean, it's not really, because the plane in it, you know, in itself sort of makes you sort of think of something two-dimensional, but it's an imperfect way of thinking, but it gives, I think it perhaps draws that distinction between the vector, which is the arrow, yeah, and the covector, which is like the gradient. The part of the problem we have is that they are the same thing when, you know, in our sort of relatively flat three-dimensional Euclidean world. Fun question. Wish I was there. So, bases. Since we've got vector spaces, TP and TP star of M, we can choose a basis for them. And I think this is, again, something that if you haven't met it before, takes some getting used to. But I'm going to just sort of start by talking about the one we most commonly use, which was the coordinate basis. So how do we construct a basis? Well, our vector T is an operator. It acts on our functions and it gives DFDP of T. But I could also take a chart and transport that vector down onto the underlying patch of our flat R to the N. And then my DFDT, I can write that in terms of, decompose it in terms of how it changes along each of the coordinate directions. So I take the derivative of the function in the with respect to each coordinate. And then I take the derivative of those coordinate functions with respect to t. And so writing it this way, you see that the first bit will be the same no matter which function you put in that slot, whereas the second bit is what's telling you about the derivative of f. So here, our dx mu by dt is like the tangent to x mu of t, but the df by dx mu are the derivatives of f in this coordinate basis. So here, we could think of these df by dx mu as being sort of, they're in themselves a vector. So they are the vector d, you know, with respect to the curve. That is, if I choose, for example, x2, the y coordinate, then I can take a little part of a curve through P that only moves along the y coordinate, and then I would take df dy. So that would be a tangent vector in the y direction. And I could do that again for the z and the x and the t. So this d by dx mu is the operator part acting on the function. And the first bit is like saying, well, this is actually associated with the direction of the tangent vector t. So here, the d by dx mu are the coordinate basis vectors, and the t mu are the components of the vector. So just writing it out again, but taking the f out of the equation, I get that my geometric object, the vector, is the same, or in notationally at least, as in that local chart, as dx mu dt, d by dx mu. The d by dx mu is the operator, that's the differential operator, so that is the basis vector. The dx mu by dt are just numbers, and those are the components of t in that basis, so those are scalars. So here, this is emphasizing what is the scalar and what is the operator. So it's being, it's sort of the geometric object is the t, but that can be written in terms of components and basis vectors, and this is what they are for the coordinate basis. And we can do the same thing for the covectors, where we write the components with respect to, and I realize at the moment we haven't really talked about D, so that's sort of like slightly hopping ahead, but hopefully this is meaningful. And so we can do the same thing for the covectors. So this D is really like that gradient that I was talking about before. So I'll just pause here and just, I'm not sure exactly if this was how Luis covered it with you, but if you just want, if there's anything that's not clear, just ask. Just grab a hold of your piece. Okay, so that's a coordinate basis, but actually it's often quite useful to use non-coordinate bases. And in that case, the components of a vector or covector might not be directly related to a particular direction. So it might not sort of coincide with a particular axis. And so a general basis, any vector can be written in terms of its components with respect to a particular basis. So here I've written down a general basis. So the basis vectors are the E's, and they're labeled by an index. It's a basis of an n-dimensional space, so there's got to be n of them. And I've decomposed them with respect to the coordinate basis. So the d by dx mu are the coordinate basis vectors. So here, the elements or the components of this general basis vector are given by this Ea mu. So this is your Feuerbein or Feuerbein And it's telling you this, you'll see this a lot if in supergravity, but this is really telling you about a general basis. It says that the mu is your standard coordinates in some local chart, and these are the components of this general basis. Sorry, I thought I heard a question there. So one of the ones that sorry, was that a question or is it just someone clarifying something?
Can I ask something?
Sure.
Can you repeat what was the A index?
The A. So the A is labeling which basis vectors. So for example, you might want to use, if you're in three, well, let's even take a two dimensions. So two dimensions, we've got our Cartesian basis, dx, d by dx and d by dy, the unit vectors in the x and y direction. So a general basis, I'm going to have two vectors, because it's got to be two vectors in a general basis, because it's a two-dimensional space. So I would have an E1 and an E2. And an example of an E1 and an E2 might be a polar basis. So that I might have a D by DR, which would be a radial vector, and a D by D theta, which would be an angular coordinate vector. My D by DR, I would decompose that as I think it is X over R D by DX plus Y over R D by DY. So this is where I'm going to find if this actually works or not, this thing. Let me try writing it down. Of course, I know what's going to happen. None of the pens are going to work. So here, I'm saying I've got d by dx and d by dy. So my ER would be d by dr, for example. But I believe that is x over r d by dx plus y over r d by dy. So that's just, that's not quite there. Can you see that?
Yes. Yeah.
Just about. I'll get out of screen. So that's an example there where I'm writing a new basis vector with respect to my original coordinate basis, and these are the components. So that is ERX, and that is ERY. So the A just labels the new basis. It might just go 1, 2, 3. In this case, I guess I called it R because R has a very intuitive meaning to us.
Thank you.
Okay.
Can we do a similar definition if our manifold is not like a smooth manifold, but a manifold with singularities or with boundary?
So for singular, it's quite funny, I'm giggling there because there was a program at the Fields Institute on manifolds with singularities. So I know there's quite, I'm not an expert, I'm very much someone who's focused on the physics of gravity, but I think for sure so I think with the proviso is I've kept everything being C infinity, you can certainly have finite C manifolds, C2, C1. If you have a singularity, I would sort of say that largely you avoid the singularity and then you have to develop, an understanding of what happens as you approach the singularity. I don't know how far or what we've got to be careful of if you get to C0 or C1 manifolds. Physics-wise, we really want things to be at least C2. And I think me saying I want things C infinity is largely just to make life easy. There's one other thing I wanted to say. Sorry, could you just repeat the question? Because I think there was two parts of it. There was the lack of differentiability, and then there was something else.
More than differentiability, I was thinking that if at some points in your manifold the dimensionality changes in somehow, like if you have like a isolated singularity and your tangent space is like bigger, or if you have a boundary so it's like less dimensionality, that A, like you wouldn't have an index that runs to n but to n minus one or something bigger. So I don't understand how that base, general basis, would be able to change smoothly.
So for a boundary is one dimension lower. And we know how to deal with boundaries, and we will be doing boundary, or at least, you know, we will be doing submanifolds. So a boundary is a lower dimension, you know, it's one dimension lower. And yes, we do know how to deal with that. If you have a higher codimension object, so for example, a string running through space, then it's again a submanifold usually. So we can, there is form, you know, there is a formalism for dealing with this. So there are issues if you want to do it within the context of general relativity, because gravity is nonlinear. And so while you can have a codimension one object being singular in a well-defined way, it becomes problematic for a lower dimensional object. But we can do lower dimension objects just from a mathematical perspective, and we will be doing that. I'm not going to be giving up on my level of differentiability, though. So it'll be a nice, smooth submanifold in general. All right. So anyway, just to say, obviously, although we need a metric to get a sense of things being orthogonal or being unit in length, that is a very common basis that's used. And it just says that, you know, the metric, if you take this dot product of two basis vectors, you get eta. So this is quite a common basis. Something else I wanted to talk about was the abstract index notation. And this was really introduced by Penrose. And I think largely as a way of bridging between the mathematicians and the physicists, or to legitimize, if you like, the way we do our calculations. So what we often do, and I'll certainly be doing this once we get to actually studying, you know, sort of gravitational physics, we tend to write T mu, and we mean the vector. We don't mean the components, we mean the vector. And then when we do a geometric operation, such as covariant derivative, we'll write the equation that I've put there. We'll write covariant derivative, nabla of T, grad mu, T mu is the partial derivatives of T, plus the Christoffel symbol. So we'll write stuff like that. And we're quite happy with that. And it's totally consistent. And yet, mathematically, I just said those T mu were the components of the vector. And so the scalars. So they shouldn't really be having any sort of Christoffel symbol. They shouldn't really be seeing the connections. So what's going on? And what Penrose realized is that it's kind of a shorthand. So the vector is the geometric object. If we take its covariant derivative, what we're really doing is taking nabla of the components of T contracted with some basis. So if we do that formally, and again, you know, this is skipping ahead slightly, but I know you've seen it, so I feel okay doing this. We then take our covariant derivative first of the components and second of the basis vectors. The first part is just our covariant derivative acting on a scalar is just a partial derivative. So that gives us the first term on the right-hand side of the first equation. And then the second bit is the connection. Nabla acting on a basis vector is what gives you the gammas. And then if you pull all that out and look at what are the components of that object with respect to a mixed basis vector and covector, you will indeed get the equation that's up higher up on the slide. So it is simply a way of making calculations more efficient if what you're interested in is doing the calculations rather than understanding the structure. So again, it takes a little bit of getting used to, but it is completely sensible. So one of the things that you might find is, because a lot of what we're doing in the early parts of this course is the mathematics, I'll often be doing geometric notation. And so when I put down TA, I really mean the scalars TA. And so when I take grad of them, I'm just going to be getting partial derivatives. And that can take some getting used to initially. So just be careful. That's what I'm trying to say. I'll try and make it fairly clear. Usually I'm going to signpost when I use geometric notation, because that's the one we're somewhat less used to. And I probably won't make such a big deal when I flip to the abstract index notation. So just that was just a sort of warning. Okay, and then I just want to kind of wrap up a bit, a home stretch, last lap, talking about coordinate transformations. So here, this is making contact with the sort of 19th century way of doing differential geometry. So if we have our original coordinate basis, d by dx, and I want to transform, I'm in an overlap of two coordinate charts, and I want to transform to the new one, which is the primed one, then if I do that on the underlying r to the n, to go from d by dx, it's simply dx prime by dx, d by dx prime. So that is how I do a change of coordinates. But t is, whatever t is, the tangent vector, it doesn't care. It lives in the manifold. It really doesn't care about a local chart. So it's the same thing, and it just doesn't see this transformation. It's not affected by it. So let's just look at what happens. Our t is a set of components, t mu, times the basis vectors, d by dx mu. And under the coordinate transformation, d by dx goes to dx prime by dx, d by dx prime. And so I get this composite object, t mu, dx prime by dx, times the new basis elements. And so I have to say that these are my new components, T prime, new prime. So this tells us how the components of T transform. And that used to be what people would say the definition of the vector was. It's, you know, this set of components. If you do coordinate transformation, it has to transform contravariantly. That's not a geometric definition. It's quite accurate, but it's not a geometric definition. But you may still see it in some textbooks. And this is the sort of origin of this covariant and contravariant. It's whether it varies with or against the coordinate transformation. So vectors are contravariant and covectors are covariant. But in general, we tend to say, does something transform covariantly? And that's sort of here, you see, for the t primed, it's dx prime by dx. For the omega primed, it's dx by dx prime. And so this, of course, leads you immediately to the problem of differentiating a vector. If you take the dt by dx nu, then if I do a transformation on that, the d by dx goes to dx prime by dx, d by dx prime. But the new components of T are or rather, yeah, the old components of t are dx by dx prime times the t primes. So when I take that partial derivative, the first term I get is great. It's just the transformed dt by dx. But then I pick up these second derivatives of the coordinate transformation. And that is not a covariant. It's not a sort of geometric thing. So we're going to dig in a bit more to that. But basically, this differentiation here, by jumping straight to taking dt mu by dx nu, what that has done is it's looking straight into the r to the n. It's looking at the chart. It's not looking at the geometry. And if you look at the geometry and you want to try and say, how does t change? Well, you have to say, well, hang on, what am I comparing it to? I've just got one t at p. Am I comparing it to what happens along the gamma curve? In which case, that's not at p, that's at a different point. So I have to figure out, how do I get my t to that new point? And that's one thing that we'll do with the Lie derivative. But then what about the way t changes? Maybe I've got a vector field that's defined over a whole region. And how do I know it changes off some curve, off the the curve to which it is tangent? So the reason that we can't just, that we have to think about what we're doing with differentiation is because we are trying to compare things not at the same point. Therefore, they're not in the same vector space. So we can't just add them or subtract them. So I want to just at the very end to introduce, to sort of look forward to Friday by introducing one thing that is sort of a differentiation, which is the Lie bracket. So here I'm going to consider the commutator of two vectors. So uv minus vu, it's an operator. So I can take that operator, I take v acting on f, and then I act on that with u, and I realize I've missed an f there on the left-hand side, and then I can do it in the reverse order. So my, gosh, this is peppered with typos, this one, I apologize. So my v of f in some local chart, v of f is v nu df by dx nu, not mu. And then I act on that. That gives me a new function along the curve that's defining v. And then I act on that with u, again at p. And then I do it the other way around. And now I can sort of skip back and look at, you know, what I did with my differentiation. I've got u dotted with dv by dx, and then I've got uv times the second derivative of f with respect to x mu x nu. But on the second part of the expression, I get v times the derivative of u, but the second derivative of f, because partial derivatives commute, those two terms cancel. And so all I'm left with is u dotted with dv by dx, so u mu dv nu by dx mu minus v mu d by dx mu of u. And so this object here, this is universal, and here is my f df by dx in the coordinate basis. So I can say that this term in brackets is a new vector, and I call that the commutator or Lie bracket of u and v. And so I'm just going to leave you with a little exercise to do over your lunch break, to just check that if you do the coordinate transformation on these expressions, once you've corrected them for the typos, that indeed that Lie bracket, the bit that I've highlighted, which I hope looks highlighted on your screen, that that is indeed covariant under a coordinate transformation. So that's almost perfect timing. And I'll just finish by asking if there's any more questions.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
So when we write in the abstract index, when we have some index, it's actually a scalar. But when you wrote the tetrade as summation of Vn fields, that is a vector, right? It's not a scalar.
Sorry, what? Is it on this slide or?
When you define the Vns, like e to the power a, which was e to the power a mu partial mu.
Sorry, there's a lot of background noise and I'm having a bit of trouble. Can you tell me if I'm on the right slide?
No, can you go back?
Back?
To the slide when you defined the tetrades.
This one?
Yeah, here. So here EA is not a scalar, it's an absolute vector.
Wow. On the left, EA is the vector. On the right, EA mu are scalars.
Yeah, so my question is regarding like notations. So in general, when we write EA, it's actually a scalar, but in the abstract index notation that you defined.
This would be the abstract, sorry, the second bit, the EA mu would be the abstract index notation. Because A is a label. A is just a label telling you which basis vector you're dealing with.
Okay. I see. So basically we have like four or basically n vectors at each point in the manifold, and then we are projecting it to like Rn. And
I'm sorry, I'm not catching that.
So at each point in the manifold, we have n vectors, and then we are projecting it to Rn, and E mu A are the coefficients, which are scalars.
So these EA mu here, strictly speaking, are scalars. But I think, I mean, I'm sorry, I don't know if I'm answering the question, but if you wanted to do abstract index notation on this, you would still write that EA mu, but it would be the mu that would be the abstract index caret telling you it was the vector. And the A would just be a label telling you which of the basis vectors you were talking about when you wrote it down.
Yeah, that answers my question. Thank you.
Okay, good.
I have another question. So mm-hmm. What is the geometric definition of vectors?
So I've kind of given that with that tangent vector definition. Sorry, let me find it. That is how it's defined in differential geometry. I have the picture though more that's scribbled down there, which is this notion of something with a direction, or if you like, the two sphere, you know, a vector that's sitting in this plane at the North Pole. That's a picture, but the geometric definition really, or geometry definition, is this linear operator, which of course is more formal. It's not a picture.
Okay.